Caught Offside with Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes. Caught Offside from the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Andrew Gundling, JJ Devaney. What's up, brother?
Oh, we sit here, a chastened nation, basted in maple syrup.
Not feeling very patriotic today.
No. We are.
Well, I mean, what was that?
That was disgusting.
What was that? Oh, that was just such an awful use of 2 hours of one's life, watching that.
Now, why don't you tell everybody what we've got on the show before I get smug?
Okay, well, obviously we're going to talk a lot about what happened last night and just, you know, the macro and the micro, like what happened specifically in that game and where we are. It's been 2 years, almost to the day, since the U.S. lost to Trinidad and was eliminated from World Cup contention. Are we just running in place? Like, nothing is changing. There's almost a regression. So we'll get into all that. We do have a Wheel of Football for everybody today for some just like quick hitting international stuff that happened outside of CONCACAF. Bobby Warshaw, who we've wanted to talk to for quite some time, he's going to join the program. We were going to talk, well, we will talk MLS with him. It was supposed to be primarily an MLS postseason primer. It wound up kind of getting split into that and a discussion on the U.S. men, because how can you have him on and not talk about what went on in Canada last night? Big mailbag, which I'm sure will be filled with negative mail demanding that Greg Berhalter not only be fired, but possibly imprisoned.
I've taken that in a different direction because It's just all negative.
All right. And red cards, man of the match, all that. But you, of course, wanted to stop the podcast so you could tell everyone how smart you are.
Well, no, but I text you at the weekend. And what did I text you? I said we need to do a podcast Tuesday night immediately after this game because something is in the waters. Something's a-coming.
And I said to you, what do you like? You were being very coy.
Yeah.
It was like you didn't want to say what you wanted to say, so I had to drag it out of you. I said, well, what are you implying to me right now? That Canada are going to win? And you said, yes.
Yes, nothing else.
I give you credit. A week ago or whatever, 5 days ago, you did say this.
Yeah, and look, I had a look at the Canada team who I don't pay enough attention to, and I thought there's some talent there, there's some pace. I don't like the options at centre back or defence that might, you know, be pressured or troubled by these guys. We're going to have to hang on to the ball. We're going to have to battle. And also, John Herdman had this team completely pumped. The Canadians were at DEFCON 4 last night, and we were not even in that vicinity.
Well, they had described it as a cup final for them, which, if you think about it, like, that sounds silly. It's CONCACAF Nations League. You know, we don't know how seriously to take this tournament yet. But if you're Canada, think of how the new World Cup qualifying format works. Whether you like it or not, and personally, I do not like it.
Mm.
But it is reliant upon your FIFA world ranking. Like, we've always joked, oh, the FIFA world rankings, who even cares about them? Well, all of a sudden, you need to care about them a lot because they really, really matter. Canada, the top six in FIFA's world rankings will qualify automatically for the Hex. Most of you know this already, but for those who don't, now you do. Canada is seventh. So for them, a win against the U.S., who inexplicably are 21st in the FIFA World Rankings, which continues to speak to just how ridiculous the FIFA World Rankings are, but it is what it is. So if you're Canada and you're 7th and you have a chance to build up your resume for the World Rankings by beating the team that's 21st, that is a cup final for them. That was massive for them last night, and they played like it, and we absolutely 100% did not.
No, they unleashed the dogs of war. They won every single tackle, every single 50-50. Christian Pulisic afterwards spoke to Soccer by Ives Gilarsep, and he just said, look, they seem to win every ball. We seem to have no energy. It was just a malaise of a performance.
It's the U.S.'s first loss to Canada since 1985. JJ, it's the first goal that we've allowed against them in 12 years. I guess the first goal by Canada, which really kind of broke it open, it was well-deserved, and it was just, to me, it just kind of summed up the game perfectly, because it was like, sometimes you'll score a goal and you'll be like, there you go, that's a team goal right there. Well, this was a team allowed goal. You had Michael Bradley kind of giving the ball away in just a very bad
so
part of the field.
So casual on the turn.
Slow. Very just slow in how that was developed. But then even after that occurred, you think, okay, well, they've kind of recovered, and the ball comes to Tim Ream, and he has a chance to clear, and it's going to be no harm, no foul. And he then passes it directly back.
What was that?
Yeah, it was just like a calamity of errors. And then on top of all that, DeAndre Yedlin is not tracking Alphonso Davies, which how can I even be uttering that sentence? I don't know if it was fully on Yedlin, if maybe Aaron Long could have helped, but I have a hard time putting it more on Long just because, like, you're asking Long to then cover up Yedlin's original mistake. It was just like, you're all to blame. All of you. This is a complete team-allowed goal. And that's really just, like, how the whole night felt. It was just a failure on the part of every single guy out there with the possible exception of Zach Steffen.
It was crazy that as we approached halftime in Toronto, Ian Dark, whose mood was dark...
I'd say from about minute 10, they were ready to pounce. They identified the fact that this was not going to be fun, and they are going to bring all of you viewers down with them.
We're going to hit the doom setting now, guys, and we're going to hit it early. Because Dark was saying things like, this isn't going well. And on the 35th minute, I think it was, he said the words that will stick with me from this game. The US just need to get this to halftime. What?! It's 0-0 against Canada in a CONCACAF Nations League game. How are we in this position? We just need to get in. What are you, like, it sounded as if Northern Ireland were playing Brazil in Mexico 86. If we can get this to halftime 0-0, you never know. What? Just terrible.
It feels like we're still talking about the game specifically, but it's hard to separate the two. Like, this feels like the new normal. And I don't know if it's probably a combination of two things. It's probably a combination of we're in this bad moment in the history of U.S. soccer, and CONCACAF is not what we think it to be 10, 15 years ago.
Look, we said on the podcast, and again, this isn't us being smug. This was the opinion we took, that what Jurgen Klinsmann was saying was palpably false in terms of where this team is. Like, we can't go off gallivanting across Europe and play Holland and Belgium and Germany and think that this is going to improve us when we can't handle what's on our own doorstep right now. That is the level we're at.
The new World Cup qualifying format, because this game and this CONCACAF Nations League, it essentially is replacing, like, the second phase of qualifying to get into the hex. As an American fan right now, you should... thank God that is the case. I'm not saying that the U.S. still wouldn't have found a way through, but the fact that this portion of qualifying is no longer really a meritocracy.
Imagine
if the U.S., Mexico, and Costa Rica are in, and nothing can really alter that. It seems horribly unfair.
It seems as if they've changed the format at the time when things have never been more even below Mexico and Costa Rica. When there's this kind... like, if you're Guatemala... or one of those Central American countries watching that last night, you're like, scrap this new system. We want a shot at those guys.
Yeah, I know.
And they're not going to get that.
You're right. And it's not a meritocracy, which kind of, to me, flies in the face of what sports is supposed to be all about.
Well, it's about, sports is all about meritocracy. It's also about money. And part of it is making sure that the big markets make it to the World Cup.
Watching that game last night, the other thing I wanted to ask you about, because you've been beating this drum for a while, and I really felt that way watching the game. You know, Canada's back line, while good, they're not filled with, like, magicians on the ball. If there was ever a night you would think to be pressing them high, and especially with the mood of the game, like, if Ian Dark sensed it when he did, then, you know, obviously, like, Ian Dark's not just speaking for himself. It felt that way. You could tell early on that this, like, the energy was just not there. It was a different sort of negative feeling for the U.S. Like, something like that, if Berhalter just screams, let's go, press high, like, that can change the entire tenor of a game. Like, where was that?
I go back to his original press conference. It was part of the two points he made. He was going to have this passing progression style. He explained that, and this was going to be a team that was going to be aggressive in the press. It hasn't been. It isn't. And also, Andrew, read the room. When you see Piette and Arfield and Liam Fraser, when he came onto the field, flying into tackles with that intensity, you've got You've got to up yours. Why not press their fullbacks? Why not press their centre halves? Their centre halves were able to stroll and progress into midfield, give the ball to Arfield, who was then able to get the ball to Alphonso Davies or whoever else you know needed to get on the ball in the attacking third. Why are you allowing that? Also, if you're pushing Weston McKennie forward, a guy with that amount of energy and playing, certainly for the first half at least, playing him beyond the football, why is he not pressing? Josh Sargent, no pressing. Pulisic kind of naturally presses a little bit, but not that much. No coordinated press. Take the fight to Canada. They're taking the fight to you.
They certainly were.
Blood, thunder and guts.
And you saw that in
what
moments
they promised.
Too. You're right. And like you saw it in little moments. And one of the things I do like about Weston McKennie, not even the player Weston McKennie, I'm talking about the attitude of him. Like Canada, Weston McKennie to me seems like the guy who always will play with that sort of attitude.
He was
like,
involved in...
Like Liam Fraser, like Canada, so okay, Canada's going to come out. You're the U.S., you've pushed us around for 35 years, no more. And Liam Fraser, who comes on as a sub, gets frustrated with McKennie and just flat out kicks him.
Yeah.
And McKennie then starts S. And like he's always, I feel like every game I watch him, he's like, I feel like he's kind of a red card waiting to happen because he has that in him. But I feel like right now, you know, there's a time and a place where I'll say, you got to tone that down. But this is not it.
No.
I sometimes wish we had 11 of those out there.
But the problem with it was, I was like, yeah, McKennie, yeah, up in his face.
Yeah.
Lay down the gauntlet. But all that energy, when the ball was restarted, just evaporates. Mm-hmm. You've got to carry that into the tackle.
What is going on?
Another thing. Early on, we were getting some joy. And when I say some joy, the tiniest, teeniest amount of joy down the right-hand side from Jordan Morris. Why not press, try and win the ball back and get Morris in? Mm. Like he was, there was so much space for Yedlin and Morris in the first 10 minutes. And we never used the ball.
Well, some of that I feel like is two-pronged. One, yes, it's our own, at times our own incompetence. As a team. But the other thing, like, this is one of those moments where I do want to give Canada some credit. Like, I don't want this to be entirely about the U.S. and their failings. Canada, like, whenever the ball was in the middle of the park, Canada choked.
Swarmed.
Like, they absolutely choked the middle of the field. And the U.S., I do believe that they did want to get it wide to Yedlin.
But they couldn't.
On the right. Pulisic, especially on the left. There was a moment when Pulisic was in space by himself, but play was so choked out in the middle of the park, he couldn't get the ball. And you saw him throw his arms up in the air. He was clearly frustrated. So, you know, some of that is like, we've got to find a way. But some of it also is that the opposition is just not going to make it easy. And Canada was perfectly set up to prevent us from doing what we wanted to do last night.
There was a real verve and energy about them. Like, I think if you watch the highlights back, you'll see that any time a US player got on the ball, there was two to three guys ready to swarm around him. Pulisic absolutely suffered from that on the night. And that's where you're like, that's, and I know I'm jumping ahead now to probably the next question. That's where I'm, if I'm Greg Berhalter, I am not taking him off.
Well, let's talk about that. You're right. I was going to bring that up next. Berhalter said after the game, because when it happened, with the way certain other guys were playing for the U.S., to see him, and I know he hadn't been playing well. There was no question about that. It was a bad night for Christian. But to see him being the one taken off, I just said, this isn't happening. What are you doing right now?
There were several candidates that could have gone before him.
Christian Roldan was having such a bad game.
Like, shocking. Absolutely shocking. And just think of it in this terms. Now, Berhalter said afterwards, well, Christian been suffering with something of a flu, so that's why he came off. Pulisic really kind of said, I'm fine. He said it to Berhalter on the bench in a strop. You could see him mouth the words, I'm fine. And he said it afterwards in the post-match interviews. He said, I'm fine. It was a little something, but I'm fine. Read the situation, Greg. This is a guy who is not getting minutes. This is a guy who's the main focus for the US soccer media. It's not happening for him. And I'm not saying that should feed into your tactical plan necessarily. But take Roldan out, make a change there, and tell Pulisic, drop wide, drop deep, do something. Just get away from the attention for a little bit. 10 minutes. Just find yourself and get back into the game. You often see that in games. Instead, he kept looking for the ball and the same thing's happening. He turned into pressure. There was 3-4 guys around him. Yeah. But like, that's Berhalter's job to manage that scenario. Do switch it up. Make a change. Do something different that frees Pulisic a bit. Taking him off just seemed, and again, Greg Berhalter owes nothing to Frank Lampard, owes nothing to Christian Pulisic's Chelsea career, but read the situation. Him coming off on the hour, being given the hook on the hour, was just such a bad look, and Pulisic looks utterly anguished.
He did. There's no question about that. I would like to know, and if Berhalter said this, you can stop me, but I would like to know what had been communicated pre-match. Like, if Christian Pulisic is suffering with flu-like symptoms, whatever that means, and Berhalter said to him, look, I want you to play tonight. This is an important game for us, but you, in the condition you're in, I can't ask you to play 90 minutes, and I'm not going to, and I'm going to take you off
but
after
it didn't
hour.
Seem like there was that agreement. It was a little bit...
Because of Pulisic's reaction.
Yeah.
But the only thing that I wonder is, he's such an intense competitor. Everyone you talk to about Pulisic says that about him. He knows he had been playing poorly. He sees the score being what it is. Maybe he suddenly, maybe he's not feeling quite as bad as whatever it was he was feeling 24 hours ago. And on such a poor performance, he probably is thinking, there's 30 minutes left for me to salvage this. I can still, I can bring us across the finish line and we can win this game. So maybe it was just a frustration in him that, yes, the plan was what it was, but, we can deviate from it. I'm okay. Please give me the chance to right the wrongs of what I've done the first 60 minutes.
It's worth noting as well, I think, and it's something that we shouldn't get away from. On the 50th minute, remember Canada? I think it was Larea had that big chance and he pulled it past the post.
Yeah.
And it was 0-0 at that point. And literally straight after, Pulisic had the chance from Jordan Morris, who fed him. He's got to score.
He has to, yeah.
And I think
he usually does.
And I think coming off 10 minutes later, it's still in his head. Because he mentioned it in the post-match, in his post-match comments, I should have scored.
He wanted to right the wrongs of the
so
previous
I think
59 minutes.
If you put that together, that kind of sums up the frustration of the night.
So it's in the moment, I wanted to yell and scream at Berhalter. That's one where I have to assume that was a prearranged plan, and Pulisic's body language and action on the sidelines was probably just frustration bubbling over. So I don't know if I really blame Pulisic's reaction is kind of what you like to see, and if Berhalter had that prearranged agreement, it all kind of makes sense. That's something I won't destroy him for. I guess JJ, now closing out this portion, and we'll talk more about it with Bobby Warshaw when we have him on shortly. Like I said, we're right around the 2-year anniversary of not qualifying for the World Cup. And I just, I think if you had told me that night, okay, the next few months are going to be rough. We're going to use this time to identify young players that we can start to rebuild this process with. But in 2 years, let's reconvene and have a conversation. I feel 2 years is a decent amount of time. A Gold Cup would have happened. New players who were coming into the fold have had long enough to acclimate. Well, here we are. Here's year two. And if you're seeing progress, I would love to know what you or anyone out there is seeing, because I see zero.
You see new names on a sheet. Over the last 2 years, you've seen new names come in. That's all you've seen. In terms of progress on the field, I can't point to anything. Are we keeping the ball better? Remember the major bugbear me and you have had throughout World Cup qualifying? We used to sit there. How is it possible that professional footballers cannot keep the ball for 5, 6, 7 passes? We couldn't do it. We've regressed in that regard.
Well, it used to be
we can barely
those good teams. That's the thing. Those games used to be we don't possess the ball against good teams like Germany at the World Cup.
But no, we never.
Now it's Canada and Curacao.
I know it was always them.
We didn't possess the ball against? That's not true.
Andrew, when we went to Honduras that day, we couldn't keep the ball. When we were in Costa Rica, we couldn't keep the ball.
Right. This iteration of U.S. soccer, I'm talking when we thought we were good.
Oh.
Years ago, years ago. I'm talking about then.
But
we had
something different. We had a bit of cut and thrust. For example, up front right now, and Josh Sargent is developing, and I don't want to kill him for last night. He was anonymous, but that was partly because the supply to him was non-existent, and they didn't play to his strengths or play through him or anything like that. But we have no cutting edge up front.
Nothing right now. And the other thing that I don't want to hear this, and I've even done this at times, injuries. Where's Tim Weah? Where's John Brooks? Here's what we all need to come together and collectively understand. We've been saying that forever, all right? And I'm not talking about John Brooks specifically or Tim Weah or whoever. I'm not talking about anybody specific. I'm just saying the idea and concept of injuries. It's always going to be a thing. You can't only have 11 players. And it feels like once we have one hole somewhere, then like this drop off to what's next, it's like this massive gap where we feel the need to lean on injuries as being a reason. That's not fair. Like, injuries can't always be the reason. We have to have more than 11 good players. By the way, I don't even know if we have that. So I don't want to hear that from anybody who's trying to make excuses. Not that I've seen that, but I don't want to hear about injuries as a reason that, like, we can't judge what we're seeing right now.
I always think about the teams in Europe that I've been watching that have been struggling, the minnows, and have kind of found their voice a little bit. You look at Finland, Northern Ireland. But Michael O'Neill at Northern Ireland started off, Andrew, his first year in qualification campaign was bad. There was a lot of losses. And then they turned it around and qualified for Euro 2016. I'm not saying the same thing's going to happen with Berhalter, but they have an identity and a way that they play now. Like, I see none of that.
Can I read you a quote here, which kind of speaks to what you're talking about? Matias Almeida of San Jose.
Yeah.
He said some things, inflammatory things, about the U.S. He said this: the United States has a great team with a lot of young players with fabulous talent, Almeida said in an interview with ESPN FC. But I think in this league, and especially with the players who were born here, there's a spark that we have to plant within them, and that is the passion and the love for football. I believe they are players that if they'd been developed like in other parts of the world, they would have become really great players. With different training between the age of 20 and 23, Wondolowski, who is still scoring at his age, would surely have been better than he is now. He's done very well, but I believe he could have done a lot better if he had trained somewhere else. I think U.S. players are really open-minded, very intelligent, and work hard, which is important as well. The main crux of that is what he said in the first part there. The spark has to be planted within them that there is this passion and love for football that he's suggesting the U.S. players don't have.
I can't buy into that. I really can't buy into that. The passion and love, these are such intangible. They're ethereal qualities. You know what I mean? Like, and you can't tell me that Pulisic or Jordan Morris don't have passion or love. Now, what could you say about Jordan Morris? The opportunity to go to Werder Bremen was not taken. And you could say maybe staying in MLS has seen his career take a different trajectory. Maybe he hasn't improved in the ways he would have had he been in the Bundesliga. Those are arguments you could make. You can make the argument, and I'm sure Almeida would make it too, is that a lot of the guys that play in our own domestic league, it's not passion and love. There's no fear. Because they can't be relegated, they'll end up on another team, they'll get swapped around. There's no jeopardy in their careers. Maybe you could look at that. But as for passion and love, I can't say that.
I don't buy it either.
I can't.
Now, maybe he's just like trying to grasp the right words, because passion and love, I think, is totally unfair.
What does he mean, though?
I don't think you like, get to this level without that. But I do think that there is something within the identity of American soccer players that existed 10 years ago that I don't see now. And there is like
Ian Dark in the this is a direct quote from Dark, has just been all over this podcast, in the middle of the game last night. Where's that bloody minded fight that old US teams used to have?
Yeah.
Now I would ask, where's that?
Right. Like, where, who is going to be the new Jermaine Jones for the US program? Like,
but even look at Michael Bradley against England in 2010.
Right. Gucci Onyewu against Mexico. Like, I always look back on those moments. Where are those guys? I feel like we have a team right now of players who, maybe they don't believe this, but there's this sense that, like, there's this belief that their talent is enough to get them by. Talent is certainly part of the equation, but that has to be combined. We're not good enough. We're not talented enough, quite frankly, to be able to get by on just that. I keep thinking about this one line from the movie Miracle, which I guess this is an actual line from real life that Herb Brooks said about a different U.S. team, the men's hockey team in 1980, when he kept saying this, and this is from the movie.
Gentlemen, you don't have enough talent to win on talent alone.
That needs to be said to this group of players. Like, you, talent is great, but like, if you don't find that other element to bring into play here, then this is what we're going to be dealing with.
Can I make one final point before we get out on this? Preparedness. A coach preparing a team. John Herdman talked about blood, guts, thunder. Piette talked about how they have a natural hate for the U.S. men's national team. Mm-hmm. Canada were psyching themselves up. If you look at even how Berhalter conducted his interview at halftime with Seb Salazar. Is there a shortfall in what this manager can give motivationally in getting his team up for it? Because blood, guts, thunder, and then you have Berhalter at halftime talking about, well, you know, we need to adjust the diamond a bit, we need to switch the play a bit more. It was just so...
That's not fair, though.
You
think that's how he speaks to his team, the way he talks to Seb Salazar at a halftime interview?
No, but I look at him, are you seeing the kind of fire and brimstone? And I called this game a derby last night. I was pumped going into this game. I was pumped more than most Canadians or US people were. I saw this. They don't play each other often. Canada are getting much better. The US are in this meh period. I could smell this coming down the tracks, buddy.
You did. And you nailed it. We'll talk more about this with Bobby Warshaw in just a little bit. But JJ, quickly now, other things did happen in the world of football. So, you know what? It felt like the right time to do this.
Football.
Lots of various international topics have been put on the wheel. Are you ready for a spin?
Yeah, give it a spin.
Okay, here we go. And it stops on this. Superstar highs and lows.
Oh, yes. Well, Cronaldo enters the 700 club.
Yeah, by doing this.
Cristiano Ronaldo has his moment. What a phenomenon he is. 700 goals for club and country.
Just the way he drew it up, right? A penalty against the Ukraine with the fans booing without mercy.
But the worst thing was 699 against Luxembourg was this delicious chip over the goalkeeper. Talk about being built out of your moment.
Yeah.
By the way, Ronaldo joins Müller, Gerd Müller, Frenick Puskas, Romario, Brazilian Romario, mm-hmm. who was just an unbelievable goal scorer, Bishan, and Pele in the 700 club. Also, quick note, Cristiano Ronaldo has 700 goals in 973 games. This is active players. Lionel Messi, 672 goals in 828 games. And then it's Zlatan, Luis Suarez, and Robert Lewandowski who make up the top scorers, club and country.
Messi's going to get there, and he'll do it with a higher goals per minute ratio.
Yep, he will.
There was one stat that put this in perspective that I saw from ESPN FC, which is kind of mind-blowing when you think about it. They tweeted, some perspective, if your football career started at 18 and you scored 30 goals a season for 22 years, you would retire at 40 with 660 goals. Cristiano Ronaldo has 700.
It's amazing.
30 goals every season for 22 seasons would not be enough.
And I remember his breakout season in the mid-noughties with United. And when I say breakout, not when he became a good player, but when he started scoring these absolute avalanche truckloads of goals, I'm like, wow. Well, a winger that does this, that's amazing. And I saw it as an anomaly. And since he's become more of a central striker, it's...
The interesting thing for me has been his progression with Portugal specifically, because I feel like we generally look at the age of 30 as sort of a turning point in the attacker's career internationally. Like, I feel like that's when they kind of recede into maybe more of like a substitute role. With Ronaldo, JJ, he hit 30 and then he kicked it into high gear. Prior to turning 30, he scored 52 goals in 118 games for his country. Since turning 30, he has 43 goals in 44 games. That's crazy.
Yeah. The less energy and physicality he has to move wide, pick the ball up, and beat people, the more goals he scores.
Maybe.
Because he's moved centrally.
Yeah. Now, this spin of the wheel was titled Superstar Highs and Lows, Ronaldo being the high, the low, JJ, being Neymar.
Yeah, hamstring. Ooh,
forced off after just 12 minutes for Brazil against Nigeria. Like you say, it's a hamstring injury expected to keep him out for roughly 4 weeks, although with hamstrings, that number is probably subject to change one way or another.
So he's going to miss the Champions League games with Club Brugge, and he's going to miss League One matches with Nice, the big, big derby or the big rivalry game with Marseille, Dijon and Brest. So it's not...
You're right.
Awful, but it is awful because it is now such a pattern of continuous injury for him.
In the greater context of his career, we're starting to get to a point where you're going to wonder if when it's all said and done, he's going to be defined by the games that he missed, not the games that he played in. Like, think of when injuries have struck him. Just like the worst possible times. Champions League knockout stages with PSG 2 years in a row. Missed Copa America in Brazil this past summer. Suffered the injury at the World Cup in Brazil in the quarterfinals, which caused him to miss the semifinal. Like, these are injuries that are not just happening to him, but are happening in like definable moments. He's 27. He's going to be 28 in February. I mean, how much longer do you think like he's going to be in his prime as an elite goal scorer? I feel like with all these injuries and this wear and tear, and a lot of these are muscle-based injuries, I feel like he's going to, like, the drop-off with him is going to happen fast.
And don't forget how much he gets hacked in a game. He has tackled a tremendous amount. Yeah. So,
ready for another spin?
Yeah, let's do it.
England.
Yes.
Boy, it's been an eventful week for England.
Yeah, this is a two-parter. First of all, the loss to the Czech Republic, their first loss since they almost exactly 10 years ago lost to Ukraine in a game that really didn't matter in qualifying for the World Cup in South Africa. They were already through, and that was the last time they lost a qualifier.
That's unbelievable.
They had an excellent team out against the Czech Republic, and Andrew, again, we talk about keeping the ball. The way the Czechs were able to keep the ball and to dominate that game for long periods against what's supposed to be England's preferred team, it's a wake-up call. It's a wake-up call. The enjoyable period of good feeling since the semi-final is over.
Yeah, that's potentially true. Now, unfortunately, what happened next against Bulgaria, you say the good feelings, well, they won 6-0. You know, that's how it's supposed to be. But that was barely a footnote with what happened in Bulgaria and the ugliness, the racist abuse that English players were subject to, caused the match to be stopped twice.
Which is unprecedented for a qualifier. I don't think a qualifier has been stopped twice in this fashion under these protocols.
Now, the true ugliness of this, obviously, it's what the fans were doing, but it is also, as we talked about with some of how things are handled in Italy, it's not just what's going on in the stands, it's the reaction afterwards. There were many within the team and the media in Bulgaria who claimed that England was overreacting. This is a quote here. "It's quite disappointing to focus on racism," BFU Vice President Jordan Lekhoff said. "It's not serious to concentrate on that if there's a qualifier like this and we're playing against a team like England." This is like not getting it 101.
Well, it's even worse than that, because there was Krasimir Balakov, the head coach, claimed after the game that he didn't hear anything. He subsequently said, "Oh, I did hear something."
Yeah, the match was stopped twice for nonsense.
Sorry, I'm watching the live feed on ESPN, and every time Tyrone Mings gets the ball, I can hear it, and it's just, my heart went out to him. It was the most disgusting thing. Mm-hmm. And Mings barely gets his pass off, and he runs to the linesman. You hear that? You hear that? And fair play to ITV in England, who showed that entire sequence, and they showed the picture of the fascists in the stand with their black hoods doing Nazi salutes. Everyone saw it. I don't want to hear that. Yeah. That is such utter crap.
Now, I will say this. Contrastly, this is how you react. The country's prime minister of Bulgaria said this afterwards. I urge Borislav Mihailov to immediately resign as president of the Bulgarian Football Union, Prime Minister Borisov had posted on Facebook after the footage of Monday night's match was seen around the world on television and social media. He goes on, "It is unacceptable for Bulgaria, which is one of the most tolerant countries in the world, and people of different ethnicities and religions live in peace, to be associated with racism and xenophobia."
Sofia Police Department said that they arrested 6 people and they're searching for 3 more as they collected evidence about their involvement in the incidents. I mean, it was clearly coordinated as well. They came there just to throw Nazi salutes and to racially abuse players. This is Barney Roney on it. "There will be a reckoning for the Bulgarian Football Association. Perhaps the protocols will now be used more often. What is a protocol anyway? A mode of behaviour, an attempt to civilise. What protocol did we see here? It isn't enough. For now, no other European nation should be asked to play in Sofia. Lock the gates, let the plastic seating moulder, the concrete crack." That's the way I feel. That's the way I feel.
I don't know how this goes away. Punishments don't seem to matter.
Here's the thing. He goes on to say, "The idea UEFA can realistically staunch this kind of performative racist protest is laughable. How can they stop it? These Bulgarians were not having a moment or allowing their usual high standards to slip. They were gleefully taking the opportunity to abuse black footballers and to demonstrate in some cases that they are fascists. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Yep. Awful. Awful scenes. Sadly, I don't feel like it's the last time that we will see them. Want to do one more spin here?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. And, ooh, I like this one, JJ. World champs in trouble. France struggling this past week against both Iceland and Turkey. They do come away with no losses, a win and a draw.
No, but
it didn't feel good.
No, and a general disquiet about this team that we've talked about this before. We got crushed for it, actually. Me in particular, said how drab and dull they were on the way to winning a World Cup. Did they deserve to win the World Cup? Surely. Were they the best team at the World Cup in terms of entertainment? Not by a long shot. And now it's becoming a little bit more in sharp focus for Didier Deschamps. Julien Laurent wrote this: France scored just twice in two games. Both goals from Olivier Giroud and both from set pieces, a penalty in Iceland, a header on a corner against Turkey on Monday. It's not good enough. The heart of the problem, Julien says, and it's an old debate in France and caught offside towers, might well be Deschamps' DNA as a manager. As we saw in Russia, when France won the World Cup, Deschamps is more of a defensive coach, always conscious of the balance of his team, with a mentality of defending well before going forward. And I can speak to this with Mick McCarthy in the Republic of Ireland. This crushing fear of when you're on the ball, instead of thinking, how can I be constructive, the thought always goes, what do I need to do when I eventually lose it? Mm-hmm. And that is just stifles creativity in football.
And look, no Pogba, no Mbappe, no N'Golo Kante. They've got
stacked
injuries. But if I'm going to say what I said about the U.S. not being able to rely on injuries as an excuse, well, I certainly feel that way, like, on steroids when it comes to talking about France. I mean, give me a break. I'll tell you what, we're going to take a very quick break, JJ. When we come back on the other side, Bobby Warshaw, former player, currently MLSsoccer.com. He's going to join us to talk about what happened last night in Toronto and to get us ready for the postseason as well. Don't go anywhere. This is how you remind me of what I really am. This is how you remind me of what I really am. Looks to place a goal, and Davis is across the line. He does, and Canada have scored against the USA for the first time since 2007. Pulisic is being substituted here, and there's no sign of any injury. This looks tactical. After an hour, and Levy's in here, and there's another goal. Canada rub it in. Lucas Cavallini completes the horror show from the United States. Canada are going to have their first win over the USA since 1985. Oh, back now on Caught Offside, the pride of Canada, JJ Nickelback. It's unfair what we just did there. Canada should be known for so much more than just being the birthplace of Nickelback.
Pamela Anderson.
Rush, if we wanted to use music, right?
I know, but
Celine Dion.
Do you not feel good about finding a proper use for that song for once?
It's not like you to remind me of what I really am.
Yeah.
Maybe this is what we really are.
Are we having fun, Greg? Greg, Greg.
So, JJ, I'm really excited now. I've wanted to talk to this guy for a while. And full disclosure, I reached out to Bobby Warshaw at MLSsoccer.com, former MLS player. And I said, hey, the playoffs are coming up. Obviously, we want to talk a lot about that. And so that was originally kind of what this was going to be focused on. And we will still get to that. But then last night happened. And it just feels like, how can we talk to anyone that has anything to do with U.S. soccer without at least making somewhat of the focus that game? So I bring in Bobby Warshaw now with MLSsoccer.com. Bobby, what's up, man? How are you?
What's up, guys? I can't tell you how much anxiety that and our call or that call just gave me. I don't even know who made the call. That's how I feel right now.
Yeah. That call was a booming blast of doom from Ian Dark.
Yeah, they were.
John Champion? Who made it? We should get that part right.
Ian Dark.
It was Ian Dark last night, yeah. But, Bobby, I had seen that you had said leading up to this game that this was, correct me if I'm wrong because these are your words, but something to the effect of that this was the biggest game of the Berhalter era. So if that's the case, then, like, what is to be said of what happened last night? I mean, how, like, are these problems that we're seeing with this team fixable, or is this just kind of like the way it's going to be?
Oh, God. Well, can't even tell you how much I didn't want to talk about these things today, but you're right. They're things we should get to. And I do think that my opinions differ from others, so I guess they're worth saying. Are they fixable? And what can you narrow that question? Like, what parts? I think that's what we need to do right now is really narrow in. Because what I read and what I see on Twitter are these incredible broad strokes, which don't actually mean anything.
That's fair.
Everyone that's mad on Twitter or mad in their columns are saying things that aren't actionable. So when I see those, I just think to myself, you shouldn't be making that comment because you don't know enough to be able to fix it. So let's narrow in here.
So I would say this. The two things that before you came on that JJ and I were kind of talking about, one of which was, I mean, if we want to go really narrow here, like, I don't know, when Berhalter came in, I just felt like we were promised like some sort of high press, some sort of like more aggressive style upfield to win back possession. We're not really seeing that in these games against like mildly talented opponents. And then the other element of it that is just a thing I always identified as being a part of U.S. soccer, just like the fabric of this program, was just like a scrappiness. And I just feel like that's kind of washed away. Like I sometimes get annoyed when people throw around the term, oh, they have no identity. Like I sometimes feel like that's a hollow phrase that we just use when a team is playing poorly. But this is actually one of those situations where I really do feel that way. I feel like there used to be an identity of what U.S. soccer was, and I feel like that's gone now.
Yeah, for sure. Do you remember, my first counter to that, though, is do you remember what it was like when Klinsmann was in charge, or certainly when Bob Bradley was in charge,
yeah,
and the team was primarily defensive, survived, hit teams on the counter? There was a little bit of creativity with Dempsey and Donovan coming off the wings, but it was a reactive defensive strategy that Bob Bradley deployed. Do you guys remember what the mood was like then and what we were craving?
Well, now I refer to those as the good old days.
I know, it's incredible, isn't it, how spoiled we were?
Yeah.
You know, we always thought that we were the underdog. We were so spoiled in world football for how we felt about our national team.
Mm.
It's incredible. Now, everyone thinks it's doom and gloom, but now we just feel literally how like 190 other countries around the world feel. So my response to that is, Berhalter was never going to high press. He didn't really high press in Columbus. It's not what he believes in. If you want to describe his defensive strategy, it's about compactness. It's more from the Mourinho school than the Klopp or Pep school, right? It's let's stay compact. Let's be hard to break down. That's priority number one. He doesn't really think about creating chances or making teams uncomfortable through the middle of the field via his defending. What he did promise, what he did prove in Columbus, is that he wants to use the ball. Right, he wants to build out. He wants to create chances via possession, which hasn't worked. I'm willing to say that if I had been part of that hiring process, I felt that U.S. soccer and the American men's soccer program needed that. That if you look at where the men's program had hit a glass ceiling in the fact that when the American fan turned on the television, in order to increase the men's side of the game, that average fan needed to be able to see that the American team was the dominant team. That if soccer was going to take the next step in this country, it had to be clear that our team wasn't just worse than the team we were playing against, which was often the case. Even if we beat them, for the most part, the United States did not look like they were in control. The second part to that is we as a culture don't value passing enough. And yes, you don't need to pass to be able to win soccer games, but if you look at Uruguay, you look at France in the World Cup, you look at the U.S. women in the Women's World Cup, they are teams that can pass the ball but chose not to, and because they can pass the ball, it lifted any other strategy they had. So for Berhalter to use this pass-focused system felt like the right decision to me, and even though it hasn't worked, I can't fault him for trying to break down the glass that, in truth, I think we're all being honest with ourselves, we wanted someone to break down. So for me, it's kind of crappy that we're throwing him under the bus for doing the thing we asked someone to do.
Yeah, okay. Can I just talk to you about something formationally then and specifically?
Yeah.
Like, okay, you say we want to pass, Berhalter wants us to pass the ball, and I think he's genuine in that desire that he wants to do that. Mm-hmm. Then look at the way things were set up last night. For most of the first half, at least most of the game, before he tweaked it a little bit, you had Weston McKennie ahead of the ball, okay? And mm-hmm. you have Christian Roldal and Michael Bradley kind of sitting there. I mean, surely you want someone like McKennie further back in the field to first of all, we couldn't win a tackle. We couldn't get on the ball. It was unbelievable how much possession Canada had. What would you say about just the way he set that up? He talked at halftime as well, Bobby, about a diamond. Like, you know, I couldn't see any of that.
Yeah. So the first thing about in terms of the grit and the ball winning ability, that to me is the unintended negative consequence of trying to be a passing team. And, you know, anybody who's played the game understands how hard it is to both have that creativity part of your brain activated and the I'm going to kill to win this 50-50 ball part of your brain activated. So when you try and be a passing team, it automatically becomes harder to be a gritty team. It's just a fact of soccer. I mean, we could probably count on two hands the number of teams in the last 20 years who have been able to do both at a high level. And it's something you have to accept. So in terms of ball winning, I'm not surprised that they missed out on that. You could make the case that that should have been priority one and passing should have been two. I get that. In terms of McKennie's positioning, man, I've watched 90% of McKennie's games in Germany. He's just not a passer. Like, we have this idea that he's playing center midfield. He's often deployed on the lineup sheet at defensive midfield in the Bundesliga, and we think that he's good on the ball. And he's not, right? That doesn't mean he's not a good player. He has some very good attributes. Trapping and passing the ball under pressure. And Canada, we should also give Canada a ton of credit. Mm-hmm. They crowded the crap out of that midfield. They made it hard to play. And McKennie is not suited for that, right? He is very, very good at a few things. Receiving and playing the ball in tight spaces under pressure isn't one of them.
Right, but
Christian Rodon isn't.
But Bobby, running onto the ball is, correct?
Agreed. So then I guess I throw it back to you. So then if his build, yeah, so how would you have deployed him? My answer is that I wouldn't have dropped him deeper. I probably wouldn't have had it done with Christian Roldan either, because I'm not sure he's any better suited to that, which is another conversation. But the idea that Weston McKennie should be some kind of facilitator for this team is just, it just gets us into a whole other mess.
No, I hear you, but I'm just thinking maybe formationally there was something else he could have done. But to be honest, to be broader about it, I'm not sure I knew what Josh Sargent was doing in that first half. I could tell what Jordan Morris was doing. That was pretty clear mm-hmm. to me. But I wasn't sure about either Pulisic's positioning or Sargent's positioning. Were we really playing with an out-and-out centre-forward? We couldn't advance the ball to them anyway, so it didn't really matter. I mean, it just seemed like a whole mess.
It did seem like a whole mess. And if you really want to get into it, I think one of the detriments to Greg Berhalter's passing philosophy is he is very stringent on positional play, right? Mm. His ideal world looks like Pep's with Man City, you know, with a single pivot, the two attacking midfielders high, the center striker stretching the field, the wingers wide, the outside backs tucked in. But you just can't – I would make an argument that you can't do that at a high level unless you've got one of four players in the world, unless you have Fernandinho, Busquets, Thiago, maybe Rodri, although who really knows. So this idea, which logically makes sense to me, what Berhalter wants to do against especially a compact defense or a hardworking defense like Canada had, is that this idea of positional play is just inherently flawed. Mm. So I understand the logic, but I'm just not sure that Michael Bradley, while I like him more than others, can do the job that Berhalter is asking.
Bobby, I wanted to ask you about Christian Pulisic because it was just hard to see him get subbed off the way that he did and see like the anguish in his body language when he was on the bench. I mean, look, I don't want to be overly dramatic. I still think the world of him as a young player, but it just feels like the weight of all of this is starting to get to him. And I just hope so much that he isn't beginning to break from the pressure of what's happening at Chelsea and the pressure of being so young and asked to carry this nation. I mean, is that possible? Is he kind of reaching a potentially dangerous moment in his career?
Yeah, for sure. Listen, the only thing I'll add to that, and listen, we're going to put this podcast out and I'm going to get 10 death threats and like I last time I said this. But I also think we need to reevaluate our thought on Pulisic and where this all comes from. Phenomenal player, right? Could certainly turn into the next Raheem Sterling, the next Mo Salah. But it's also fair to ask ourselves, this is a player who hasn't played regularly at the club level for 18 months. You know, got displaced, was never really a first 11 guy at Dortmund, you know, played because of injuries and did well. But for 18 months has been consistently displaced by other people. So why we thought he was going to go from being displaced at Dortmund to starting in the Premier League for Chelsea is on us, right? That's not Frank Lampard's fault. That's not Christian Pulisic's fault. That is on us, and those expectations were our own fault. More so, just when you look at his skill set with the national team, yeah, he crushes a lot of these teams in CONCACAF. He crushed Ecuador and Trinidad and Tobago. But also, he struggled against Mexico every time. He struggled at Costa Rica. He struggled against... He was one of the better players at Kubo, but he struggled against Canada. So it's also worth saying, like, are we wrong too? You know, I'm not saying Christian Pulisic's bad. Like I said, I think he has the ability to be a top player in the world. I just think it's weird how we actually haven't looked back on the body of evidence.
Bobby, we have a lot of Canadian listeners, and they've been in touch with us over the last 24 hours. Let's have a word on what Herdman has done with a limited side, albeit with a sprinkling of stardust. Your thoughts on Canada last night?
Amazing. Like, absolutely amazing. I mean, John Herdman got it exactly right. And I'm interested to hear what you guys think of this. For me, the right counterattack, like the right formation to play if you primarily want to be disruptors and get on the counter, is a 4-4-2 with your fastest two players up top. Because the two strikers don't actually matter that much. So the fact that you can have them kind of block passing lanes, but then just wait and get on the break, is the right way to go. And then the four players he played with Piette and Arfield and, of course, Marc-Anthony Kay going out, but bringing on a little bit more of a defensive midfield and Liam Fraser to just clog things up, right? You don't need to outplay the U.S. This is the weird thing about it. They didn't outplay the U.S. They blew up what the U.S. wanted to do. And when you blow up a team like that, they have no plan B, or they have no way to deal with the chaos. So I thought John Herdman set it up perfectly. Every single player, including the four defenders who are supposed to be the weak link, were individually fantastic, and they should feel really good about it.
Bobby, we did have you on because we want to talk some MLS, so we should do that. Now, first off, I guess, like, before we even get into some of the matchups and these teams, the new format, are you in favor of it? Do you think this was a good change?
Ooh, all right. So after dropping everything I just dropped, I can carefully say that I actually don't care about the format. It's just not everyone thinks they have the perfect idea. Yeah, the international break in the middle of the conference finals, I think it was horrible. But I don't know. I mean, I want the best teams to win, and I'm not sure that having one leg will guarantee that. But honestly, it's just not something I have an opinion on. I enjoy playoffs. I think they're fun. But how it's conducted, I don't really. You guys have a preference? Have you guys gone over your preference? I missed that part of the show.
Oof. I generally like it.
I kind of like it the way... Well, I have to see at the end of this, do I like it this way, or do I always want two legs? I don't know. I'm not sure.
Yeah, right. We'll decide after.
Yeah. And you alluded to something there. And again, I'm just wondering, because I want your take on this one, Bobby. You know, the happy to be there New England Revolution. I just feel like, and I've been feeling this for weeks, that, well, since we knew the draw anyway, that Bruce Arena has something up his sleeve for Atlanta. Am I just being wildly optimistic, or are they actually really just happy to be there?
They are definitely happy to be there, but I don't think it means that Bruce doesn't have something up his sleeve. A, because we've seen Bruce in big games. Obviously, the 2002 game against Mexico is the best example when he goes with 3-5-2. But even this year, I mean, he's played 3-5-2, 4-4-2 diamond, 4-2-3-1. He's done everything. So I would say he has something up his sleeve, but he also has changed so many times that, like, you already have no idea what's coming from the Revs in this one.
How much do you believe this is LAFC's to lose? Or is that maybe an overrated sentiment?
Oh, for sure. You win the supporter shield and you set the single season record. It's yours to lose. The only thing I would add here is I hope they win. I want the best team to win. You talk about the level of soccer in this country and in Canada. LAFC raised the bar, right? Bob Bradley's tactical approach, the way he improved the players, the tiny little details that they've made extremely important on the field. I want that team to get rewarded. I want everyone else to have to chase that team in every single way. So they are the team that everyone is chasing, and I hope that they win it all.
I'm curious about this from your perspective as an ex-pro, Bobby. I've heard NYCFC are traveling to Chicago to get a game in either over the next few days. Do you find it that in this scenario, it's a disadvantage to NYCFC to be kind of sit there and wait and have such a gap between their last game, or does it really matter?
I always felt like I wanted to be fresh, right? That I would take being fresh over anything else. And the idea that players are off their game coming off a break, to me, isn't about lack of reps, because you get a ton of reps in training and the friendlies you'll play. It's just because you have more energy, right? And it's weird to play a professional soccer game with 2 weeks of break, you know, and rest on your legs. So I'm actually surprised that they're traveling, and I get why they're doing it. But if I, as a player, I would always want the rest and the freshness.
What do you make of them this season? Are they the real deal? Because, again, not to sound like Zlatan, but there's the two components to the season, and they seem like they're a markedly better team this season under Domi Torrent. Do you see that improvement?
Yes, he definitely made them way better. And I'll acknowledge, I was in the camp that I had no idea if Domi Torrent could do the job in Major League Soccer. That if you looked at them last year, he broke something that didn't need to be broken.
Yeah.
But to his credit, he fixed it maybe even better. And I'll tell you the thing that they do really well is they have a 1-2 punch where if you get stretched, they bring their wingers, whether it's Matriza or Castellanos or Max Morales, in to play off the striker in a 3-4-2-1 and crush you down the middle and really 1-2 passes and running out the back four. But all of a sudden, if you get more compact, they throw their outside backs forward, and Anton Tannerholm and Ronald Matarita might be the best wingbacks in the league, so they can crush you going out wide. So it's really cool to see how they've created both sides of that.
Bobby, I kind of respect your sentiment of wanting to see the best teams win, and I think what goes hand in hand with that is watching the best players play this time of year, which is why you get so sick when you see injuries like Marc-Anthony Kay pulling up last night, and we don't know what Jozy Altidore's status is. And I wanted to ask you about one other one. Miles Robinson, finalist for MLS Defender of the Year with Atlanta. Darren Eales was not happy about the nature of how that injury occurred. He was on a radio interview. He said he goes on international duty, and 11 o'clock at night after a game where he sat on the bench, they're doing hard training session, and he's doing sprints, and he pulls his hamstring. Just really disappointed that he was put in that position. Does Darren Eales have a leg to stand on here?
I guess he has a leg. For me, it's a thin leg. I mean, obviously he's upset, but this is something that a lot of teams do, whether it's just sprints or a training session. I mean, the flip side of this, right, is that Miles Robinson goes without a training session. He loses his form. He loses a little bit of fitness. So I don't blame Darren Eales for being mad, but I don't think that this one is anyone's fault. This is something that a lot of teams do, and it's just bad luck.
Bobby, the LA Galaxy, I'm trying to figure them out here. So I watched the last two games fairly intently, a collapse against Vancouver and then the Houston, I won't call it a debacle, but it was kind of a debacle towards the end. They traveled to Minnesota with a sense of trepidation, or at least I think they should. Am I right in that?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to flip this back around. What would you do if you were the Galaxy coaching Zlatan? Like, how would you set that team up to get the most out of him in a way that he thrives, but also, quite frankly, that he also doesn't hold down the full 11?
That's a difficult one, because the desire to play through him is incredible. I would go to the template that they used in the first half of the LAFC game, which it was early Pavon, and it just seemed to like energize the way that Zlatan played. He was less of a focal point. He could drift off a little bit more. The ball wasn't going entirely through him. That would be the way I'd play it. To be honest with you, I'd be more concerned about just his general upset with what's going on around him, particularly at the end of that Vancouver game. I don't know what your thoughts on it are. How would you set them up?
Yeah, no, I think about this a ton, right? Because he is so incredibly talented. But, you know, what's kind of cool about this sport is that doesn't automatically make your team better. You have to find a way to make it work as a group.
Mm.
And they haven't, right? Like, they were outside the playoffs 30 games into the season. They shouldn't be let off the hook for that. And Zlatan shouldn't be let off the hook. He's an incredible player, but he doesn't really transition defensively. He doesn't really defend in the defensive phase. He slows down the game a little bit. Are these his fault? No, but they're things that the Galaxy need to address. So yeah, they should absolutely be concerned, because Minnesota is going to sit behind the ball. They're going to have no fuss about not having any of the ball. And the Galaxy are going to attack. They're going to leave themselves open to transition. And Minnesota have the single center back who is the most likely to stand up as Zlatan in this league, and that's Ike Opara. You know, the last time the Galaxy traveled with Zlatan to play Opara in Minnesota at Allianz, it was 0-0. So if you're Minnesota right now, you should be feeling confident.
Just a quick one on Zlatan, and it just seems to me that, maybe you can make a comment on this, Bobby. Why is it that they can implement this particular game plan against the best team, against LAFC, and be successful, and yet seem to fall short against other teams? Surely, if it's working against LAFC, do the same things.
No, you're exactly right. My guess is, you know, I don't have an answer. My guess, though, is that, you know, when you're the best player like Zlatan, in an easier game, you want more touches. When it gets a little bit of a tougher game, you're more willing to accept your role,
okay,
which is let Pavone create. Let Jonah Dos Santos get on the ball. Let Antuna do his running on the other side, and I'm going to play my role in the box, which is just kind of natural when the stakes get a little higher. But if you were asking me to try and tell you what's going on in Zlatan's head, I'm not even going to take that.
Bobby, before you go, if you're a novice MLS person, you're not really into the regular season and you want to get into this league and you've got some free time this weekend, if you're telling the novice soccer guy what game he should be watching this weekend, what is it?
Oh, that is an awesome question. I would say, I'm so bad at this because I don't have the novice. Probably Zlatan versus Minnesota. I'm personally really excited for Philadelphia versus Red Bulls. 3 versus 6 in the East. For me, it's the game that has the most tension, right? I like games with pressure and tension. And both of these clubs, both of these coaches are on this precipice of thinking that they can get into the top tier of organizations, but they're not there. And a first-round exit for their fan base or where the club is would be borderline disaster for both of them. It would be a huge, huge failure. So I like how both teams play. I like that they have young, growing managers, and it's game filled with pressure. So I'll say Philadelphia versus the Red Bulls.
That was actually mine as well. Also, because I feel like not only is it a rivalry, but it's sort of like this reversal of roles. Like Philadelphia is usually this underdog, and the Red Bulls are a team that are more accustomed to finishing atop the conference. And I feel like it's kind of this like switcheroo between the two. I'm very curious to see how that plays out in a postseason matchup.
Yeah, same. It's always fun to see a team go from underdog to having the pressure on their shoulders, and just how a group of individuals, you know, maintains that switch.
Yeah, good stuff, man. It should be fun. Hopefully more fun than what we witnessed last night. That's a low bar to set. I'm sure we'll be able to clear that. Thanks, Bobby. Hopefully we'll do this again soon.
Thanks, guys.
Great stuff from Bobby. Look forward to having him back on again.
He's great. Maybe if you want to get into the minutiae of the game, he's really, really good. But he's interesting anyway. I like reading his stuff on MLSsoccer.com.
Yep.
I go to him for my half-baked opinions.
Really enjoyed that. So I'm sure we'll be speaking with him again maybe the next time the U.S. reconvenes in November. JJ, we've got a mailbag coming up. But first, I want to tell you, JJ, I got to tell you something. Hiring can be a slow process. Just ask Cafe Altura's COO, Dylan Miskowitz.
Dylan!
He's back. He needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company, but he was having trouble finding qualified applicants, as can sometimes be the case. So he switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job so you get qualified candidates fast.
You hear that Dylan broke up with his girlfriend?
No.
Yeah, Stacy. Done.
No.
Splitsville.
Well, we have to pick sides.
She was seeing on the side her yoga instructor, Kenneth.
No. Kenneth?
Yes. Kenneth, who's down the plaza from the coffee place.
Poor Dylan.
Oh, man.
JJ, Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so he could focus on the most relevant ones. And that's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ziprecruiter.com/offside. That's ziprecruiter.com/offside. OFFSIDE. ZipRecruiter.com/offside. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
That's Stacy.
Yeah, that's not okay. That hurt me to hear that.
Yeah, it was true.
You have a mailbag in front of you.
At CEO Soccer Pod on Twitter, at @CaughtOffsideESPN on Instagram, CaughtOffsidePod@gmail.com. Follow us on all the social medias to interact with us and talk to us about things and listen to my snark. Bryant kicks us off. How's life? Life's good. I know it's a few days late, but I attached some pictures from the Columbus Crew Soccer Club new stadium groundbreaking. It was one of the best days of my life. As you know, the Crew have been a big part of my life and are very close to my heart. After the ups and downs of the Save the Crew movement, the stadium groundbreaking was that tangible reality that the Crew will indeed be staying in Columbus. The city of Columbus officially made October 12th Save the Crew Day. Sorry, Saved the Crew Day.
The new stadium, like the pictures and all that, it looks awesome.
It does look great.
Yeah.
And
so, the renderings, the artist renderings
so
of what it's...
What happens to Mapfre? Did they knock it?
Yeah, probably.
I guess so. Or maybe they give it to a... it's just...
I'm sure it will be knocked down.
It hosts concerts and stuff.
And what do you think they're going to do with the new place?
Okay, fine. Wow. I just wanted to lament for one of the great cathedrals of U.S. soccer. Nate Perius of Montana. Dear JJ and Andrew. JJ and Andrew. Long-time listener, first-time emailer from Montana. First, let me thank you for all the entertainment over the years, as your consistently reasonable and nuanced analysis has been a bright spot in a world overflowing with inevitably meaningless hot takery. Thank you very much. The drop of your pod is always a highlight. Thanks. Unfortunately, Nate went on to go in depth. Nate, this is 700 words long, so I have to cut it down a little bit to basically this. All of these factors have me fearing the possibility of Everton being relegated for the first time since the 1950s, in the same year Liverpool win their first domestic league since 1990. That's everything is there. He goes into great depth about schedules. Not only has our Merseyside rival had an impeccable start to the season, they have had done it against the third hardest schedule in the league. Everything like this. Am I being overly dramatic, or is this something I should be worried about? Everton relegation, should he be worried? Nate from Montana.
So I will say this. My answer is twofold. The first part of it is, from Everton fans that I've kind of like spoken with, he is not alone. I feel like they really believe that they're going to get relegated. Now, maybe I'm going to sit here and have to eat my words several months from now, but to me, there's like, no. They're not going to get relegated. Now, I probably said that the first time around when Newcastle went down. Like, just a thing that, I couldn't have envisioned happening. But, no. Like, there's too many other teams, I think, that are beneath what they're capable of.
Are you going to spend a few more months loitering down there? Possibly.
Maybe it's a season where they, like, finish 14th or something like that. Even that feels, like, I don't know. I just feel like in the end things will balance themselves out. I don't know.
Nightwolf 1996. Conrad wants to know if United will be okay. That's it. Will United be okay?
Well, to do that, you would have to define what okay means. Does he mean finishing top four? Because if so, I couldn't sit here today and tell you that they will.
I think they're going to be just like mid-table, kind of 7th, 8th, maybe. At best.
So I guess our answer right now would be no.
As we sit here.
I don't know that I could tell you that.
No.
With a straight face.
Paul Risdale looks ahead to the weekend. Liverpool have been excellent and Manchester United have been awful lately. Am I crazy or overly cynical to think that United are going to spoil the party after the international break?
Mark Goldbridge said that to us last week. He said, and he's very negative. I know he's a United guy, but he's very negative about them.
Negative.
And he said he thinks that's a game that they'll come out and win.
He thinks it'll be 0-0 draw.
Oh, that's
but
right.
He wouldn't be surprised if they won.
Right.
I wouldn't be surprised if United won either. That is one of those games. It's an absolute.
Here he is.
What?
Old tough exterior JJ. I'm putting up walls and protecting myself. From disappointment.
Stay away from the pain.
Stop acting like you think United are going to win that game.
No, but they could draw it. They definitely could draw it. And look, they've scuppered us before. Look, last season, the 0-0. We came flying into that one.
That was a scuppering.
All right. And finally, Set the Panda. Which international team would you like to manage if you could?
Let's see.
I'm just going to say I'd like to manage, obviously, my home country at some point.
I mean,
and Belgium.
That was probably going to be my answer.
Belgium would be fun.
I'm trying to think of a team that feels like it's just like a team of players with great attitudes. Maybe Australia.
I want to send you to like Kazakhstan.
I think I could do a fine job there.
Oh my God. I want to send you to the toughest job in football and watch you flounder.
All right, Faroe Islands. Let's do it. Get out there and give it your all. That is the mailbag. At CO Soccer Pod on Twitter, caughtoffsidepod@gmail.com, and at caughtoffsideESPN on Instagram. What to watch for? There is a lot to watch for, JJ. Saturday, 1 o'clock, MLS's postseason begins with Atlanta United FC and New England. Injury bug hitting at the wrong time. Now, it looks like Joseph Martinez is going to be fine. I mentioned this with Bobby just moments ago about Miles Robinson. I'd be curious for your thoughts. Like, did the U.S. do something wrong here in asking him to run sprints after a game? I don't think.
No, that's standard practice.
Yeah, I kind of get like Darren Eales' frustration.
No.
Miles Robinson has played every game this season for Atlanta. Started 33, played in all 34. had a breakout season. Like, he's now on the U.S. national team picture because of what he did in Atlanta this season.
Andrew, there's...
But, like, once he's with the U.S., he's got to kind of adhere to what they want to do.
There's an argument that just sitting and then not doing any running can cause problems as well, so...
Should we make picks for each of these as we go through?
All right, let's go through them. Let's just go through them and make picks.
Okay, I'll say I'm going to take Atlanta 3-0.
I'm taking New England 2-1.
Okay, all of this will be remembered. Saturday 3:30, Seattle Sounders and FC Dallas. Hard to know what to make of Dallas heading in. They were winless in four straight until decision day when they destroyed Sporting Kansas City 6-0. So meanwhile with Seattle, they're the 2 seed. So I feel weird saying this because a 2 seed, it feels natural to think that they could be a contender to win it all. I don't feel like they're typically talked about that way, and therefore they are my dark horse in this tournament. Veteran roster, proven players who have done well in MLS's postseason before. Jovan Jones reacclimated, Ladero, Rui Diaz. I just feel good about Seattle right now.
I'm taking the Sounders 3-0.
Okay, I'm taking Sounders 2-1. Saturday, 6 o'clock, Toronto FC and DC United. Josie Altidore's status seems to still be unknown. Greg Vanney says he's feeling good about it, but he would not say that Josie is 100%. So I took that to mean he's questionable. With that in mind, this one I have a hard time with.
I've struggled. I think Toronto 2-1.
Can I say DC on penalties?
You can.
I did. I just did. Let's see, Saturday, now the nighttime. Nighttime is the right time, someone once said. 10 o'clock, Real Salt Lake and the Portland Timbers. Portland's been so poor of late. They had been winless in 5 straight before their win over San Jose on decision day. This is one matchup where it feels like home field kind of matters.
Yes.
Real Salt Lake 12-4-1 at home this year. Portland 6-8-3 on the road, which isn't terrible necessarily. But you know what? I'm gonna go with Real Salt Lake here 1-0.
I think the momentum is with Real Salt Lake, kind of. And it's amazing how they've bounced back from all that mid-season chicanery. So, Real Salt Lake, 2-0.
Okay. The one that Bobby liked the most and the game that I'm certainly most interested in, Sunday at 3 o'clock, Philadelphia Union hosting the New York Red Bulls on the shore of the Delaware River in the shadow of the Commodore Barry Bridge.
One of my favorite grounds.
One of my favorite bridges. Should be quite an afternoon, quite an occasion. Quietly, this has become one of the league's better rivalries over the years, and now they're going to add a postseason chapter to it, which is cool. MLSsoccer.com broke down. They had a list of some of the most memorable rivalry moments between these two. There was the Jesse Marsh temper tantrum in the 2016 U.S. Open Cup meeting when he started throwing balls out onto the field in rage. This season, you had the Philly comeback. They were down 2-0 when El Seno just completely took over in that 12-minute span, scored 2 goals, had an assist. There's been some occasions between these two, despite the fact that the Union don't have an incredible history. There's no team in the league that Philly has lost to more since their inception than their neighbor to the north. Yeah, but this is new territory. Like we said, Philly are favorites. How will they cope with that?
Philadelphia Union 3, New York Red Bulls 4.
What a game.
Yep.
Big
game on the cards.
That would really hurt my heart.
There's always one absolute mental game.
What a game.
That's the
if
one.
That would have be, that would then go into the list of great playoff moments. I'm going to say Philly 3-2 in extra time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then last but not least, by the way, I should say Jim Curtin says that Bedoya and Tribilco are healthy and should be able to go, which is vital for the Union in this game. Sunday, 8:30, you close it out with Minnesota United FC and the LA Galaxy. Interesting matchup here. The old guard is the underdog. The new boys, I guess, are the favorites. They're at least at home.
I'm going to go against my instincts, and I'm going to say the Galaxy win it 3-2 in extra time.
Wow, I'm going to say Galaxy 2-0. I'm sorry, Minnesota. You've had such a great season, and I kind of want you to win. But, yeah, I don't know. EPL, JJ, here we go. Saturday, 7:30, Everton and West Ham. Important for Everton.
Oh, it's massive for Everton.
That 7:30 game, too, with morale of the fan base. If they lose that, because it's the first, like, it's an entire weekend now.
Of moaning, right. Complaining, and anger, and upset, and calling for people to be sacked, and abusing players on Twitter. It's just, I think, West Ham, I'm still not convinced by West Ham yet, but that doesn't mean that they're not progressing in the right way. We're in must-win territory now for Marco Silva. They can't, They can't.
I agree.
They can't lose this one.
Saturday, 12:30, Crystal Palace and Manchester City. We'll see if Andros Townsend can replicate the goal he scored against them last year.
Right? I mean, Palace are weird, man. They're very, very weird. That's at Selhurst Park. Well, I mean, City should win it, but you never know.
Yeah. And then last but not least, the game you mentioned, Sunday, 11:30, Manchester United and Liverpool. This is a really interesting one.
Biggest game in Europe at the weekend. And yeah, look, it'll never change. I will never get over it. It happened in my formative years. I will always be. If we had Messi and Ronaldo and 15 players versus United, it's always just going into that place. It's always different. It's always special.
Yeah. Let's see. NWSL semifinals. It's all on ESPN2 for those who want to watch it, and they're all on Sunday. First one at 1:30, North Carolina Courage versus Reign FC. North Carolina, of course, the defending champs. Best team in the league this season.
Yes.
Three straight years of having the league's best record. Seattle, though, plagued by injuries for much of the season, they've had to rely on some of their youth players to get them through, and that has worked. Bethany Balser could be Rookie of the Year. She would be my player to watch for Reign FC over the weekend.
I'm not convinced by Reign FC, even though they have survived for such large portions of the season without their best player, their most influential player, Megan Rapinoe. I'm going to say North Carolina do this.
Yeah, I think they probably would be most people's pick. They are, on paper at least, they've been the better team. And then Sunday at 3:30, the other semifinal, also on ESPN2, Chicago Red Stars and Portland Thorns. This one I think is maybe viewed as a little bit more of a toss-up.
I've seen Thorns win games during this season where I'm like, how have they come out and won that? I don't think they're actually that good. I'm going to go with the Red Stars.
I'm with you. And I think that'll leave us with a North Carolina-Chicago final. We'll have to see how that plays out. Let's see, JJ, we quickly now bring it down.
Red card.
Stretch, you want to go first?
This is a whole mess. Ryan Giggs, Daniel James, the Welsh FA. This is Jamie Jackson in The Guardian. Ryan Giggs' stance that Manchester United's Daniel James was being streetwise when remaining down following a collision during Wales' draw with Croatia has been criticised by the brain injury charity Headway. Let's hear what Giggs said in the post-match.
No, like I said, he stayed down. He was a bit streetwise. He told the doctors, "Yeah, I'm just not moving. I'm just standing. I'm just sitting still. Yeah, not to get anyone sent off, but just, you know, using his nous." And like I said, at halftime, did all the concussion tests, and it was fine.
That's a kind of a shocking admission.
Yeah, using his nous for what though? If he's not trying to get him sent off, what's he? Why? I'm just having to lie down. I mean, it doesn't make sense. So James and Damagar Vida were involved in an aerial challenge in the 14th minute of the 1-1 Euro qualifier draw at Cardiff on Sunday. The incident appeared serious and left James requiring treatment to his head for around 3 minutes before the 21-year-old played the remainder of the game. Giggs stated James had passed concussion protocols, as you heard just there. Peter McCabe from Headway said, "If that is the case and James was acting, it raises serious questions about the player's understanding of the seriousness of concussion. Not only has he put his own medical team under intense and unfair scrutiny, but he has also set a dangerous example for the millions watching at home. Similarly, we have serious concerns about terms like streetwise or that the player was just using his nous. It is simply not acceptable for teams to use concussion protocols for tactical gain."
Yeah. Let's see. I'll go now, JJ. My red card goes to the Chivas Twitter account. I'm reading now from ESPNFC. "They may be the two biggest rivals in Mexican football, but Chivas did their old foes Club America a solid this week by promoting their new clothing line for them. Quite accidentally, the official Chivas Twitter account alerted fans to a brand new batch of America apparel on sale, despite the two teams being on opposite sides of the Liga MX Super Clásico divide. Of course, this led to mass confusion among Chivas fans who were left wondering why their club shop was suddenly advertising a clothing range with the America crest emblazoned across it, complete with fire emojis. The error stemmed from the same company handling the official stores for both clubs and was quickly rectified with the post being deleted from Chivas' account and then correctly posted out to America's followers. You have to wonder if that firm will be working for either side in the future." Like, I was just thinking about it as I was reading that. Like, what if I logged onto Twitter and saw, like, the Tottenham Twitter account posting, like, "Hey, check out Arsenal's new third kit." Like, I feel like my brain would malfunction. It would just be like, what has happened here? Yeah.
Weird. How? Just weird.
How can that happen?
Caught Offside's man of the match.
Very fast, you go.
Finland 3-0 over Armenia, and our friend Pukki grabbing two goals.
Oh my God, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, but it's bigger than Pukki. The result leaves Finland on 15 points from 8 matches in Group J of Euro 2020 qualifying, with leaders Italy already having qualified. Finland can secure a spot in the finals with a win over bottom side Liechtenstein at home in November. Andrew, they've never qualified for anything. World Cup or European Championships. They've had a few runs in the Olympics. They've never done it. Think of some of the players they've had, though. Pukki, he's on the lower end of it. They've had Jari Litmanen. They've had Sami Hupia. And, you know, they've had, like, good players in Scotland, like Miksu Patalainen, guys like that.
You say he's on the low end.
Well, not right now.
Let's talk in 5 years. Let's see where he is.
He'll be 39. I know.
I'm playing for Barcelona.
You know what I mean. Well, I mean, Litmanen ended up there, but yeah, just incredible. I'd never thought about that they'd never qualified. Good luck to
them. Amazing, yeah. My man of the match, JJ, goes to Petr Cech. When you find a thing in life that you love, just do it. Just go for it. The all-world goalkeeper has now taken his talents from the pitch to the ice. He signed with the Guildford Phoenix in the National Ice Hockey League South 2. Not only did he sign with the team, which is an achievement in itself, but he actually saved 2 penalty shots and was named man of the match in his first game. He will, however, continue to be the team's third choice shot stopper, though. I mean, he comes from the Czech Republic, which is really, I've always kind of thought to be a hockey nation, like Jaromír Jágr, Dominik Hasek. So he spoke about how he grew up loving hockey. But because he was such a good soccer player, he never had a chance to continue his hockey career. But now he doesn't play soccer anymore. He can still apparently stop shots, and he's picked it up.
Yeah,
so good for him.
If you listen to his interviews talking about it with Chelsea online, just such passion for hockey.
Yeah, really cool. So I always like to see that. Like, people hated Michael Jordan when he left basketball to go play baseball. I don't know, like, the guy loved baseball. It's a thing that he wanted to do his whole life. He was in a position where he could try it, and good for you. If there's a thing you love and you can think you can do it, go give it a shot.
You're only coming around the block once, guys.
Yeah. Well, hey, I was going to say this was fun. I think this was therapeutic. We got to really hash it out. Our thanks to Bobby Warshaw for kind of, in some ways, educating us on the way things are going right now. Oh, nice. Okay.
We had a chat.
But the way he lays it out, I think, is interesting.
No, that's why we had him on. Just don't
what are you making faces for?
Ever talk down to me about education.
I forgot that you're all-knowing. Well, hey, I guess I leave you with these final motivational words today, JJ.
You don't have enough talent to win on talent alone.
That's right. Don't forget that. Take care.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.